Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Wednesday, January 22nd, 2025. Hundreds of South Sudanese are rearrested after breaking out of a military detention today.
Some prisoners who robbed shops during the violent protests in Juba as a result of massacre of South Sudanese by the Sudan Armed Force and with Madani city of the Jazeera States broke out from the military police detention facility.
And an Amnesty International official explains why it accuses DRC forces and a rebel group of war crimes.
Explosives were used more than 150 times. And through that period, from January to July of last year, we were able to demonstrate that at least 100 people were killed.
These stories and more are coming up on South Sudan in Focus. More than 400 suspects have been captured after they escaped from a military detention facility in South Sudan earlier today. The police said about 600 detainees who were arrested after recent anti-Sudan protests fled the facility. Deng Gai Deng has the details for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan National Police spokesperson Colonel John Kasara says police and military forces fired guns into the air in the capital Juba as they pursued suspects who escaped from the Giada Detention Center in Juba. Kasara says more than 400 escapees were recaptured, but nearly 200 are still at large. They had been detained because they were suspected of being involved in violent demonstrations in Juba recently. Mobs attacked Sudanese residents last week and looted their businesses after reports came out that the Sudan Armed Forces killed several South Sudanese when the army captured the town of Wat Al Medeni.
Some prisoners who robbed shops during the violent protests in Juba as a result of massacre of South Sudanese by the Sudan Armed Force and with Madani city of the Jazeera States broke out from the military police detention facility in Giada this morning at 9:30 a.m. And the number were 600, where 550 are civilians and 50 are from the members of organized forces.
Luate Santimonjual, the chief executive director of the Juba-based advocacy group Integrity South Sudan, expressed his concern over the rearrest of over 400 people without a prompt legal process.
This mass detention following the violence in Juba triggered by the tragic massacre in Wat Madani raises serious concern about the adherence to justice and human rights principles. The escape from the military detention facility in Giada highlights systematic issues within our detention practices.
Joel says that detaining such a large number of individuals without ensuring the right to a fair and speedy trial undermines public trust in the South Sudanese legal system.
It is important that all detainees are treated with dignity and their cases are processed swiftly and transparently in line with South Sudan legal frameworks and international human rights standards.
Joel calls on the authorities to uphold justice and ensure that the rights of all individuals are respected. Hundreds of thousands of Sudanese citizens have fled to South Sudan since the National Army began fighting its rival Rapid Support Forces group for control of the country in April 2023. The United Nations say the conflict has displaced more than 11 million people, left tens of thousands of civilians dead, and put many communities at risk of famine. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Juba.
On Monday, we had here in the studio with us Manyoung Kerr. He's a South Sudanese-American businessman based in Juba and head of 734 Coffee. He's also an adjunct professor at George Mason University focusing on social justice. And he's been here in Washington this past week to attend the U.S. presidential inaugural on Monday. And it was just minutes before the swearing-in of Vice President J.D. Vance and President Donald Trump in the Capitol building when we were talking last. And today he joins us again to share his his experience with us. So thanks for being here again, Munyang.
Thanks for having me.
Since the swearing-in was moved indoors due to the bitter cold, which is still happening today, you weren't able to attend in person, but you did watch the inaugural. Where did you watch it?
So I watched it like just live in my hotel and all that stuff. But I went to
the Capital One Arena.
Capital One Arena and attend all the balls and all that stuff. So it was so exciting to just be there around many people.
You know. I just, before the show started, saw your video. It did look very exciting. You were there just mixing it up with everybody. And how did you find the speeches at the arena?
I think it was good. I was in front, actually, like very, very front row. Like, that's, I'm very excited about it, just to sit in the front row. It was cold, but I went in, and that's good. My ticket is good, so I'm just happy about that.
What were your impressions while you were here? You saw it, how it played out, how the Bidens, President Biden and his wife, the First Lady, met with the Trumps at the White House for tea the day of the inaugural, and that whole peaceful transfer of power, despite the strong policy differences between those two administrations. What's your take on that?
No, I think it's very professional. It showed like even political rival can give up differences and, you know, talk to one another and be the respectful they can be. I'm sure they deep down they don't like one another like that. But like at the same time, it showed decency, it showed the respects and for the countries and the people that voted for them. And I think this is one of the most amusing things ever.
And you know, when you think about it, with President Kiir in your country and Vice President Machar, I mean, they're not exactly good friends. You know, so there's something to be learned from that, right?
Yeah, I think that's something to be used. I mean, they should work working together. I think now the peace they sign is one of the signs that they, you know, they can concede the differences and work together. I think that's very exciting.
Well, so when you go back to Juba, what will you say are your lessons learned, more or less, about the U.S. presidential election and the inaugural event that you just witnessed? And how do you think it could be applied in your country?
No, I think people have to understand debate. Debate is important for the country, and people are excited, different feeling. People will express their interests differently. You know, as I'm not in the politics like that, but I'm also excited to see the country moving forward and just be happy that, you know, you can express your idea and be happy as human beings, you know, and just be a citizen, come home, enjoy your life and continues your living, you know.
That's you're just a coffee guy. You just want peace and tranquility.
That's it. Social justice and a coffee guy. That's what I do.
Well, it's a delight to have you back here. Thanks a lot, Munyang Kher, for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
So conservatives across Africa are applauding President Trump's executive orders regarding gender and diversity, while gay rights activists and the LGBTQ community on the continent are expressing deep concern. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria's capital.
On his first day as the 47th U.S. president, Donald Trump signed a flurry of executive orders, including some that reversed policies by his predecessor, Joe Biden. These include orders revoking some protections for transgender people and defining the sexes strictly as male and female. Trump's actions have sparked a mix of reactions throughout Africa. Some, like Bishop John Praise Daniel, Vice President of the Pentecostal Fellowship of Nigeria, welcome Trump's moves.
I'm very excited. I think Donald Trump has just done what is right. So how can some young person wake up and say, I don't feel like being a girl, I want to be a boy, and their sexes will be changed? We don't need that confusion. Bringing back righteousness, bringing back order, bringing back sanity to society.
But while many in Africa's conservative societies are in support, LGBTQ activists strongly oppose the decision, calling it a setback after years of progress and advocacy. Frank Ejiogo, founder of Creme de la Creme, a Nigerian LGBTQ advocacy group, warns of serious consequences.
For me, I am not disappointed. Looking at his campaign promises and what have you, we know he's going to have a ripple effect. And that might catalyze a lot of violence against the LGBT community persons in the global south, which will boil down from discrimination, which boiled down to assault, which boiled down to a lot of policies that some government agencies or nations in the global south will start enacting.
Ejiogu says LGBTQ activists already are strategizing to resist such measures.
We are strategizing on how to stand firm in what we believe in and stand firm for the community. It can only be there for 4 years. But the only thing we've been promising ourselves, the LGBT community members all around the globe and also in the global south, is to making sure that we fight back to all those policies that's being enacted right now as against the LGBT community members all around the world.
Activists are concerned that Trump's moves will increase pressure on LGBTQ people in Africa and elsewhere. Members of the LGBTQ community already face harsh penalties in many African countries. In Nigeria, same-sex relationships are punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Uganda's Constitutional Court upheld a life sentence for homosexuality offenders last year, while Mali's Hunter criminalized homosexuality with imprisonment in December. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Over 1 million people have now fled the Sudanese war into neighboring South Sudan, according to the United Nations, which said the figures show the scale of the unfolding humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands have been killed and more than 12 million forced from their homes since the fighting erupted between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in April of 2023. Most of the million people crossing the border are South Sudanese nationals who had previously fled from civil war in the world's newest country, according to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. The statement called for more support for both displaced people and the communities hosting them. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, Amnesty International says it is likely that M23 and Congolese forces committed war crimes.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
On today's Words of Wisdom, we have a Zandi proverb from Western Equatoria State.
Hello, VOA Africa. I'm Daniel from South Sudan, Western Equatoria State, Yambio. I would like to share the proverb from my mother tongue, which is said, Kairovuleli gesingo irovulelite. It means a blind person cannot take accompanied a blind person. All of them will fall. That's the meaning of the proverb. Thank you very much.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. As we reported to you yesterday, Amnesty International has accused the DRC's army and the rebel group, M23, of bombing densely populated areas in attacks that they call war crimes. Christian Rumu, Amnesty International spokesperson in Nairobi, Kenya, tells me that both the attacks happened in eastern DRC more than 150 times in the first half of last year.
In this very short span of, 7 months, saw that the explosives were used more than 150 times. And through that period, from January to July of last year, we were able to demonstrate that at least 100 people were killed in those incidents, which actually continues till today. I was just reading yesterday one explosive that hit the MSF hospital 2 days ago on the 19th in Masisi. So these are kind of continuing. So the death toll that we are alluding to into this report is very conservative. So it's much higher than that.
Why is the army and why is the rebel group bombing these infrastructure places and health facilities?
Officially, at least what we see on the justification of them using these explosives, they're saying they're aiming military targets. But what we have found through this research is that the weapons they are using, if you look at the great rocket they're using, the 122 millimeter, for instance, they are not guided. So you cannot say that you are aiming at a military target near an IDP with such a weapon, which is not guided. That's just not possible because they're going to be a civilian casualty. We submitted our findings to both the MTD3 and the DRC officials and last December. We did not get any feedback on that. So we don't know exactly why they are using, at least from that perspective, but what we read on the public space, they are justifying we are aiming military target, but at the end of the day, using the type of the weapon they are using that are not guided, it means that, you know, the civilian casualty are going to be there.
Well, if they're doing that, it would seem to not just imply, but it seems pretty clear that neither side really cares that much about the collateral damage of these civilian deaths.
Absolutely. And it's that to our concern as well. And that's why we are really hoping that, you know, as we are calling for an immediate stop to the use of these explosives, there needs to be accountability for the use of this type of weaponry in densely populated areas and around the IDP camps. And also calling for the ICC, which has, you know, reopened its investigation on the DRC, to make sure that, you know, they take into account these types of incidents that we believe that, you know, could be qualified as war crimes.
Right. You've said that these actions would constitute war crimes likely. Do you know if anybody with the ICC is actually on the ground in the DRC there?
It's not an information that we have at the moment, but we believe, but, you know, since the last year's engagement by the ICC, that yeah, they certainly would have, you know, people on the ground, if not themselves directly, but there's also the UN Joint Human Rights Office that is on the ground that we believe that are able to collect this information.
What is the locations of these areas in the DRC where these explosions are happening?
Yeah, so it's a mix of, you know, small towns. We have like two case studies that we studied in this report. You know, Mweso, for example, which is a small town where one rocket hit a house that was full of people, where we registered like 19 people killed and several others injured. On this particular case, it was a group of people who have fled other areas, other towns around, coming to Nyasale for security and safety. There are like 17 people were killed. And for that second incident that we studied, it's the information we collected, information shows that, you know, the rocket was coming from M23 held territory. And the first one from Mweso, it was coming from a hill that was held by the FRDC, the Congolese army.
That's Christian Rumu, an Amnesty International spokesperson. He was speaking to me from Nairobi earlier today. Civilians in Gabon are being encouraged this month to register to take part as voters in presidential elections scheduled for August. The planned elections are envisioned to end a 2-year transition to civilian rule. Voter registration began on January 2nd and is due to conclude at the end of the month. Gabon's political opposition says voter registration has not been as robust as expected because civilians believe transitional President General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguami wants to confiscate power. Nguema, that is, wants to confiscate power, assertions that Nguema denies. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Ainsi, parmi les mesures phares, la révision des mécanismes d'identification des électeurs.
Gabon State Television reminds civilians that they have up to January 31 to enroll and be eligible to vote in the nation's presidential elections expected in August 2025, as ordered by Transitional President General Brice Clotaire Oligui-Nguema. The elections are part of a plan for a return to constitutional order after an August 30, 2023 coup that ousted longtime President Ali Bongo Ondimba. Gabon officials say at least 300,000 new voters who have either reached the legal voting age of 18 or who are not yet registered are expected to be added to the 860,000 or so civilians that registered as part of Gabon's November 16, 2024 constitutional referendum and whose names are already in the elections database. This week, officials of the Central African nation said Sino-State functionaries were deployed to encourage civilians to register before the January 31 deadline. Ministers dispatched to towns and villages this week are expected to work with voter enrollment teams and make sure civilians are formally registered as voters so they can participate in the August elections and cast ballots. But Gabon's opposition and civil society groups say civilians are not heeding calls by government officials to register because they are not sure Nguema is ready to hand power to civilian rule. Cyril Bisengu is the deputy coordinator of Yes Volunteers, a group created in 2024 to encourage civilians to take part in Gabon's electoral process.
Nous avons, au niveau de notre plateforme, initié une opération que nous appelons d'inscrire.
Bisengu says he is not sure that before the ongoing registration of voters ends on January 31, at least 300,000 new voters would have registered as Gabon's government expects. He says many young people, Yes Volunteers contacted to register, say they are not sure about transitional ruler Nguema's willingness to hand power to civilians. Bisengu spoke on Gabon's state TV on Tuesday. Jean-Remy Yama is the leader of Unitary Dynamics, one of Gabon's leading worker trade unions and member of Gabon's Senate, appointed by Nguema. He also expressed skepticism.
Je déplore tout simplement qu'on ait manqué l'occasion de faire un...
Yama says if Nguema truly wants to hand power to civilian rule, he should have allowed Gabon's parliament and senate that voted a new electoral code on Monday to set up an independent elections management body that will assure free, fair and transparent elections. He says by asking a minister appointed by transitional rulers to register voters and organize elections instead of creating an independent electoral commission to organize the polls, Nguema is indicating that he wants to confiscate power. Gabon's constitution, voted in a November 16 referendum to lay the groundwork for elections, bars transitional government members from running in the 2025 presidential polls, but permits Nguema to run for president. Nguema has not said whether he will be a candidate, and the transitional government refutes claims the military leader is planning to maintain power. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Celebrations erupted in many cities after the United States, Egypt, and Qatar announced a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas to end more than 15 months of fighting in Gaza. The agreement includes the release of hostages taken by Hamas in return for releasing Palestinians jailed in Israel. But some experts are skeptical about the future of the deal. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy has details.
Some Middle East experts say implementing the ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel will be day by day, as it is designed to be carried out in phases. The 6-week deal went into effect on Sunday, with Hamas beginning the gradual release of hostages it captured in 2023 and Israel freeing some Palestinians from its prisons. Stephen A. Cook is a senior fellow of Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There are a whole host of questions, and I think most important among those is what the Israeli government has said over and over again, that it will not fully withdraw from the Gaza Strip, meaning that it would stay in the Netzarim corridor, this east-west axis that bisects the Gaza Strip, from which the Israelis have been launching military operations, and importantly, on the Philadelphia corridor, which is right on the Gaza-Egypt border.
Cook was speaking during a recent webinar with the Council on Foreign Relations, a policy research organization in New York. Cook said the agreement is complicated as the first phase is 6 weeks long and negotiations will start for the second phase in about 2 weeks. Since those talks will be based on how well each side thinks the other has performed, he questions the chances of success for the second phase.
Phase two is about ending the conflict permanently. And of course, as I alluded to, there are serious questions and clearly opponents to a ceasefire, both within Israel as well as among the Palestinians. So I'm somewhat skeptical that this is going to move from a stage one to a stage two to a permanent end of the conflict.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said Israel retains the right to resume the war in Gaza should negotiations for the second phase prove futile. Elliot Abrams is a senior fellow of Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It's very interesting that one of the initial Hamas demands was an end to the war. Israel has not said that, isn't saying that, and, you know, there's a perfectly reasonable possibility that 1 or 6, 8 months from now, they will be back in Gaza.
Abrams also was speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations. While U.S. President Donald Trump has called for peace in Gaza and advocated for the ceasefire, Abrams says he doesn't think renewed fighting will be a prime concern for the Trump administration. Abrams said Trump's priority is to free the hostages Hamas holds and that later fighting won't be a top item for the administration. World leaders have issued statements celebrating the ceasefire agreement, but there has been little talk on resolving the core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what the future looks like for Palestinians in the war-torn strip. The ceasefire deal is a milestone in the war that began in October 2023 when Hamas fighters from Gaza attacked Israel, killing about 1,200 people and taking around 250 hostages. Israel responded with an assault that destroyed much of Gaza's infrastructure, killed nearly 50,000 Palestinians, and displaced almost all of Gaza's 2 million residents. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps it up for us this Wednesday. We encourage you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs, breaking news, and news updates. If you somehow missed the beginning of this broadcast, just go to voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Zaman Garuju by Emmanuel Kembe. Again, we're listening to the song Zaman Garuju by Emmanuel Kembe, and I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Joe Giel, producer, Kwame Afori, and myself, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk with you again tomorrow evening on another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.